You're listening to a DayOne.fm show.
How does one go about supplying and recycling a million cups?
You have to be cost competitive with single use. It allows us to wash really quickly at up to 10,000 cups an hour. A big change we did in America as well was we used to sell festival to festival, like sold to R&B, sold to Splore, sold to the stadium. In North America, a lot of the market's monopolized. So like Live Nation will give us 36 festivals with one contract. We'll get 52 venues with one contract.
Yep.
And so the whole events industry is going to be the first to move to reuse in the next 3 years. North America, California's banning all single-use plastic cups, and it's just going to be state after state.
Welcome back to Diaspora.nz, where we're on a mission to seek out and profile the hidden gems, the best founders, operators, researchers, and emerging leaders of the great Kiwi expat community. Today, we're chatting with Ryan Everton, who is the founder and CEO of Turn. I had the pleasure of sitting down with Ryan live in San Francisco. We trace his journey from running an underground tuck shop for meat pies at his boarding school back in Whanganui to university in Otago, where he founded a little company called Globalit, which went on to become Turn, an amazing growth story and global leader in the fight against single-use plastics. He's raised over $25 million from the likes of Ashton Kutcher and Guy Seri and services millions of vessels to major music festivals like the 400,000 to 500,000 people at Austin City Limits, and he's rolling out with major brands across the US like Starbucks. We spent a bit of time exploring how Ryan's farming background and Kiwi work ethic shaped his entrepreneurial drive, his views on the doing the work versus building the machine and delegating as a company start to scale, and his thoughts on preparing the next generation for a rapidly changing world. If there's one thing you can do to help us, it would be send this episode to a friend, maybe it's an expat in your family, a founder, or an aspiring entrepreneur who might be inspired by Ryan's story. This is a great episode, so let's go get stuck in. Ryan, it is an absolute pleasure to have you on Diaspora.nz. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Give us the setup first. I want to hear the headlines. What is Ryan Everton? Who are you today?
Who is Ryan Everton today? He's a Kiwi turned American, lived here for 5 years, solving a global problem with single-use plastic, and have been doing that since law school at Otago.
I admire the resolve to get through it. Talk yourself up, though. I mean, you've raised $20-25 million today. You've been having your product in some of the biggest festivals in the world.
Yeah. So a founder of Turn, you know, backed by Ashton Kutcher, Guy Seri, Guy's the world's largest music manager. We do all of Live Nation's major music festivals in North America. You know, Austin City Limits is 1 million cups in one weekend that we just wash and reuse. And we've got a bunch of technology that makes all these sports, the new stadiums, everyone more money, which is really the big reason they work with us.
Okay, so we're going to talk a lot more about that. I want to get into the million cups and the logistics of managing. I want to get into the how do you wash a million cups and actually do the process. I also want to go way back because there has got to be a unique story behind this. What are the influences? Take us back to your school in Whanganui. What were the family influences? Where did you get started?
I grew up on a farm and family were all entrepreneurs. We had a meatworks family farm. Mother was a real estate agent. Brother ended up having his own business as well. During high school, I had my first business. The New Zealand government banned meat pies in schools. And so, yeah, Helen Clark banned meat pies, banned Coca-Cola.
How did you get away with that?
And so I started my own internal tuck shop in my dorm room at Collegiate. And, you know, it was hugely successful because everyone still wanted to eat pies, even though pies weren't available.
Okay, so I'm seeing some common threads here already. So many Kiwi-based founders came off farms, that's one.
Yeah.
A number also started tuck shops, you know, dorm room, shops of some variety. Do you feel like there's a reason for that?
I think there's a mindset of you have to do it yourself. The harder you work, the more successful you've been. I think it's a New Zealand mentality in some reasons from the farm. And so I think at a young age, I'm like, shit, if I keep on this trajectory, I'm going to be a lawyer and working in Auckland at a Russell McVeigh or something. At 15, I'm like, fuck, if I don't start now, you know, time goes too quickly.
So at 15, you start dealing pies from the dorm room.
Yeah, I almost got expelled at the time. You know, the headmaster brought me in.
You get dragged all the way to Helen's office.
Yeah, exactly. So it was my first time of having an investor as well. I have a wealthy Taiwanese friend who was at school and he bankrolled the whole thing and we both made a bunch of money.
No way. Okay. Yeah,
he's now a dentist. And
you're now still an entrepreneur out there in the world. There is a distinct sustainability angle to your more recent decade. Where did that come in? What was the moment you realized you had to save the world?
I think David Quinn, who you met, you know, I was starting businesses at the time. David had worked early on with Steve Jobs running a, you know, $6 billion fund for him. And he was like, there's too many lawyers in the world and you only have this short time to live. And so by the time you've started a business and made money to try and save the world at that time, you might as well start a business that saves the world now and also makes money. And so I spent a lot of time trying to figure out what that was. But he was a huge influence on me, like not just making another company, but making a company that by the age of 40, I'd feel proud of. Mm.
put us in your shoes in that moment. And also, this was around the time you were going through the Audacious competition where we first met in Otago, yeah. I believe. What else were you considering? How did you land on the single-use plastics as the problem that you needed to solve personally?
So I was at a rugby game at the Forsyth Bar, and there was a clear issue with single-use plastic cups. And I thought the fact that they're all just being thrown on the ground and thrown away, like there's a clear problem, which is a business opportunity. Another one is I felt at the time, but I never went on, was just permaculture farms, like all those buildings with roofs or spare backyards that all could be localized farming at some point, which I think it will be one day. At the time, you had to pay for your phone bill. I don't know if you remember, like every minute was a paid, or you get like 100 minutes for every $10. And I would just keep calling people I didn't know. And I was spending, you know, $500 on my phone bill at the time, listening no, 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 until one festival signed up and said, hey, yeah, we'll do it.
What was the first festival?
It's gone out of business like most of these festivals do. It was R&V originally. We did like a small activation, and then it was called like Tuborg Sounds, like Tuborg, the beer brand, sponsored it.
So you had your first festival signed up. Did you have your suppliers waiting for the money to come through to source the first cups?
Yeah, exactly.
A little bit of a chicken and egg problem to get the first one off.
Yeah, I convinced the producer to do a prototype tool, our own custom cup, but it's like an aluminum cool that's really cheap to produce. So they front loaded the money if I could get the deal signed. So I got the deal signed, they front loaded the tool, and then I paid them back.
And you had none of the infrastructure to wash a million cups at that point in time?
No.
You collect all the cups yourself?
Yeah, I had dishwashers in my mother's garage in Lake Taupo at the time.
Let's say the, you know, the Audacious Business Competition, you're a judge, you're a mentor, you've just met young Ryan.
Yeah.
What would you have told yourself with the wisdom of what you now know?
I would have told him probably not to get into an operational business, okay, to be honest. One thing I realized coming to Silicon Valley, it's like the businesses with the most scale and most growth is like the businesses that are software, not operational heavy. And we're changing the world, saving the world, but hugely operational heavy. And I keep thinking, what is the business like ours? It's like Airbnb's worth more than Hilton Group, but doesn't own a hotel, you know? It's the same thing. Like, how do we be the leader in reuse and be still making the same impact without having to wash a million cups?
Tell me about the move. As you say, I mean, Silicon Valley is notorious for being the center of software. You are a technology company in some aspects. When did you move over, and what was the original drive?
2019, we'd become the largest operator in Australasia, and we thought we were doing great. And we did U2's tour, and the manager of U2 at the time, Guy Oseri, really wanted music artists to move to reuse because there's a movement happening predominantly in Europe. And these artists that he was managing were all asking for plastic-free concerts. And so he asked to invest, and he became our first investor. His view was, it's like there's a global market for you outside of Australia, and you should be growing.
Was it always obvious you'd come to San Francisco? I would have thought entertainment stuff, you could wind up in LA, you could wind up somewhere else.
Yeah, part of it was that, like, for us to scale, we needed technology. And so it's such a hub for technology. And so in order for us to get to the growth we've got to, we've had to rely on technology, where in Australasia, we had no technology, essentially. And so that was one of the major reasons for moving here.
So I remember you telling me on the back of that round in 2019, it might have closed in the weeks before the pandemic hit.
Yeah.
My first reaction was, wow, you were running a business that was supplying reusable cups to live events at the time when all the live events in the world just stopped indefinitely. Yeah. What's going through your mind at that point in time?
I think in business, there's so many ups and downs that you start to just become numb to these punches. And so I think I was probably just numb at the time, and just you keep on grinding. And I think sometimes these things happen for a reason, you know, one door closes, another opens. And Guy and Ashton invested, it was their first sustainability investment ever. And they'd made a lot of money from technology, and they were gung-ho of like, okay, now we've got some time to work out how do we build this tech so we can scale up. And so we spent a year and a half hiring agencies, you know, we rebranded, bought on the world's leading design firm, fully re-engineering what we'd built in Australasia and saying, okay, we do X, Y, and Z, we'll be ready for scale come 2021, 2022.
So you operated with the assumption the pandemic would end sometime, would be back to normal sometime.
Yeah.
Maybe it's a year, maybe it's 2 or 3 years from now. But yeah, in the meantime, you've got the, you know, invest in yourself.
And the ironic thing was, New Zealand of all countries was still open. So we're still making a small but like nascent business in New Zealand operating. So it still felt like you had a business. It was only a limited market. And even Live Nation, everyone in Live Nation knew there was only one festival that happened in 2020. It was R&V that they owned. And so everyone knew about New Zealand, knew that that festival was happening. And so we had both that going, plus time in America to build what we needed to build.
So you could be the dubious title of the sole supplier of reusable cups in 2020.
Probably, yeah, that's like true that. As well.
Yeah. And there's a good, I suppose, opportunity within that period. You're investing in the systems, the infrastructure, the technology. What does that mean? So how does one go about supplying and recycling a million cups?
So to be able to supply reuse at scale, you have to be cost competitive with single use. So the big thing is we can wash cheaper than you can produce a cup. And so we've got a bunch of washing technology that we deploy that allows us to wash really quickly up to 10,000 cups an hour.
So it's conveyor belts and sanitizing
automation.
And
ironically, also in 2020, there was a Kiwi company called Compaq that sold to Tomra. They're like the largest fruit automation company in the world. And so a Kiwi guy built a lot of the equipment. He went to Otago with us and he lives in Central California. And so he re-engineered all of our dishwashers at the time. You know, he also didn't have work, so he started re-engineering these machines. So we built this fully automated dishwasher that would help us scale up.
So the equivalent in his world was the apple, the fruit processing lines as they come off the orchards and they're getting sorted. And sounds like we have to get him in for an episode.
You should.
Yeah, we'd have to do that shout out. Tell me about the scale of those. I mean, how many festivals are happening at any given time around the world?
Our smallest festival in America is larger than our largest festival in Australia, just for like... Yeah. Our smallest festival would use about 100,000 cups, which Splendor in the Grass in Australia was using 100,000 cups. For us to scale up, we needed like two things. One, wash cheaper. And then two, how do you get all of those cups back with these consumers who don't even care about recycling or never have? Like America wasn't even in tune with that. So the other really important technology we built was this loyalty reward scheme. Every time you returned a product, you could win a prize. And so at these festivals, we'll have like 400 bins at Lollapalooza in Chicago. There'll be 500,000 cups there, but everyone's returning them because it's convenient. All the cups are orange and the bins are orange. So it's like basic, even if you're drunk or on drugs, you can still return your product. But the big reason people return is you could win something and people like to win or the chance to win. So they keep returning all the products. You know, in New Zealand, we used to get like 80% of our cups returned. Now we can get over 90% returned at these huge festivals in North America because of that.
If I recall correctly, there was a partnerships business, an angle on this as well, where you can have an event partner, a sponsor, brand the cups.
Yeah.
Have you had to go build a go-to-market organization for the sales and the relationship development on that front as well?
A big change we did in America as well was we used to sell festival to festival, like sold to R&V, sold to Splore, sold to the stadium. In North America, a lot of the markets monopolize. So like Live Nation will give us 36 festivals with one contract. We'll get 52 venues with one contract.
Yep.
And those businesses make money through sponsorship. They don't make money through selling drinks. And so our rewards platform allows them to make more money. So Liquid IV, for example, can sponsor the rewards platform and offer Liquid IV VIP upgrades or 20% off Liquid IV at the supermarket, all these other prizes for returning your product. And then Liquid IV's got a bunch of data of why people return, how many times they returned, who returned the most, and who did they give rewards to and redeem them.
So this is what you mean about building the technology platform behind the product. So what's the team look like today? You must have an engineering base based here in San Francisco.
Yeah.
Where are you around the world and what is the dimension of the crew today?
So crew, Australia, New Zealand, US, and then a lot of our engineering's in Pakistan, but we deploy in Europe as well, but normally like huge activations. Like we did the Arid World Cup in Qatar and we did FIFA's UEFA event in Turkey last year with Pepsi. So we're doing bigger one-off deployments as well for those guys.
You'll be flying around the world and spending the time on the ground with them and building them out, or is the team?
The team does it. I've got a Kiwi guy actually, a VP of Ops, who ran Red Bull North America's music festival business for like 10 years here. He's based in Atlanta, Georgia, where our biggest hub is. And so he manages everything. Stevie Atkin, his name is. He's unreal because Red Bull was a similar business. They had infrastructure. They're going to all the festivals. And so he came on and was able to integrate the same teams across the country to be able to go activate all of our major events using his like Rolodex.
The round you raised last was the 2019 one. Talk me through the business side since then. I think I saw you were participating in the Google for Startups Circular Economy Accelerator. Was that an investment vehicle or was that just more of a group?
It was a group connection vehicle more than anything. We raised our Series A last year, 2023.
What was the process building up to it?
Growing revenue, socializing with investors, getting profitability. Like those are sort of the three big things it felt like the investors were looking for at the time.
And looking to the future, I mean, you've clearly got a product that's working. Is the single-use plastics a deep enough market that you're going to be able to scale into forever? Or do you go to adjacent reusable products? Or what does the future look like at this point?
I mean, single-use plastic's huge. We just did Starbucks' largest reuse test today. Like Starbucks uses 7 billion cups a year. And that's just in North America, like not including global. So like 7 billion, even if we're doing, you know, a portion of that market at 10 cents is like a $1 billion business. But it's more than that. The problem for these stadiums is they need to go to reuse because legislation's now here. When I first started, there was no legislation. But the reason they choose us is one, because we're the cheapest. So like we're cheaper than their single-use plastic budget, but we can make them more money for our rewards platform. And so the whole events industry is going to be the first to move to reuse in the next 3 years in North America. California's banning all single-use plastic cups at live events coming next year. So like the Warriors, we do all of Live Nation's venues already in Northern Cal. We'll do Southern Cal later this year. All of the venues will be reusable by the end of the next year in California. And it's just going to be state after state. But that's a small market. It's the real market. It's the quick serve market. Chick-fil-A is another partner we're launching with next year.
What's quick serve? Sorry. So you're buying a over-the-counter
fast food business.
And you can have a drink and you can toss it into the recycling instead of the bin on your way out the door.
And 80% of those consumers are repeat. Like they're coming back weekly sort of thing. So we did our Starbucks test. The reason Chick-fil-A signed up to us, we didn't even set this up. Chick-fil-A and us were sitting in the car about to go look at a Starbucks return experience we'd built for them. And there was like two Ubers rocked up with like a stack of cups. People jumped out of the Uber, returned the cups, jumped back in the Uber and left. And they were just returning a stack of cups because they wanted to try and win. And it seems a bit ridiculous, but it's like a lottery system. You don't throw your lottery ticket out. And so if you know it could be worth something, you return. And one of the issues with Starbucks, we had one across from a middle school and the kids realized you could return cups to win. So next minute, we were just going through more cups than anywhere at the Starbucks because they kept asking for free waters so they could try and win.
It reminds me of the referral schemes, the McDonald's monopoly. It's like the people that would hang around the airports and grab the trolley and return it for you so they can collect. I've always believed in the power of human incentives, and you've clearly harnessed an incentive mechanic here.
Yeah.
That's really starting to work. So in some cases, the original version was you'd take your equipment, you'd take your cups, you'd roll them out of the festival, you'd pick them up and take them home again afterwards.
Yeah.
In these cases, these are going to be more permanent establishments. You're going to be installing the, you know, the sanitizing equipment on site in the Chick-fil-A at the Warriors Stadium.
They all come back. Like a Chick-fil-A, I think every parking lot of space is worth $1 million to them. So there's no space to wash products because you're missing $1 million in their mind.
Wow. Okay.
And so all of these companies are trying to outsource and maximize space, and the space is worth a lot of money. We've set up hubs. So in California, we've got a hub, Atlanta, we've got a hub, Texas, we've got a hub. We'll probably have around 6 hubs by the end of next year. Mm. And so the more scale we get, the more we build out hubs essentially that support operations.
So it's never totally distributed on site, cleaning, sanitizing. It's always hub and spoke model. You're going to have like one place that serves a city center.
Yeah.
I'm with you. To recap a little bit, you've got a regulatory tailwind here where certainly in California and perhaps other states across the US, they're mandating you cannot use a single-use plastic, you must use a reusable plastic. Yeah. Are you the only or one of a number of providers that can sort of come into that void?
Yeah, since we started, there's been probably two main providers that came into the void. The big difference probably is one, they can't do it as cheap as us is a big factor, and then they don't rely on technology.
Their other path would probably be just doing it themselves. Like they might place a bulk order of cups out of China and they might, you know, install their own equipment on site.
Yeah.
But you'd say, no, we've got the better cleaning technology and the full pickup and service and clean and return is going to be a cheaper and a better experience.
Space is a limitation. Space is worth money to them. And then labor is a complete nightmare for companies now. Like even just getting staff to run your bars is a nightmare. And so they don't even want to think about hiring staff to wash their dishes. And so why not just outsource it when it's cheaper than you're doing it yourself and you don't have to worry about the labor and space being wasted.
What is the biggest version of this? Every fast food restaurant and every festival in the world is using reusable plastic. What does that mean? What kind of scale and volume are we talking?
I mean, like I said, Starbucks is just alone 7 billion products. Chick-fil-A does like a meal every 1.7 seconds is a meal served at a Chick-fil-A. There's billions of products that are going to go towards reuse. Someone's going to own infrastructure for reuse. Like Ball produces 90% of the cans in North America for beer. And, you know, they produce Cokes, Pepsis, ABIs, Heineken's, Coors, all of their beers produced by Ball. I think there's going to be like a Ball of reuse, like cheapest, largest Walmart. Someone always does that in America. And that's going to probably happen in California first, and then it's going to be across North America in the next few years, that you won't go to a restaurant and get a disposable cup and you won't go to a live event and get a disposable cup.
If you weren't building Turn today and just having your exposure to the circular economy, accelerator crew, other founders that you've met that inspire you in this space since then, what are the next two or three big problems that you would consider throwing yourself into?
I hate to bring up AI, but it's like it still hasn't scaled. Like we're getting married later this year and my sister-in-law in Cambridge was writing a speech for my brother at the wedding, you know, and I'm like, Joe, just get ChatGPT to write it, you know, like,
yeah.
And I think something to do with AI and climate will like really scale. And so I don't know what it is yet, but that's definitely going to be a big piece.
Let's shift into the, how do we bend the universe to help you? Who are the dream partners you'd like to be working with? Are there any festivals out there and any customers that we could help you get introductions routed to?
I mean, I think the dream customers, you know, Live Nation used to be our dream customer. And then it's like, who's the next one? I think all major airlines, right? Now we're in discussions in New Zealand and Delta Airlines here. So all major airlines is big, and then all of the major fast food companies is another really big one for us.
That'd be a good one to nail. Talent, like who are the superstars that could really unblock you right now? Someone wanted to join your team.
I think a CTO who's built like a huge hardware business and software business is probably one really key element.
Talk about the role. Imagine I'm that person. Why are you pitching me on working for you, and what is the unique work I get to do?
I think the big reason people join us is because of climate first. It's the same reason David Quinn convinced me to do this. You know, it's like, do you want to spend your life just building another camera company or another scooter business? Or do you want to spend your life building something that your kids are going to be proud of and you're going to be proud of, and you can go to sleep at night knowing you made a difference, not just made another $1 million? I think you keep seeing these people, particularly in Silicon Valley, who made the $1 million pretty quickly. But then they're like, oh, fuck, like I want to do something good, and they don't know where to go. And I think Tern's one of those places where you can go.
Yeah.
And that's a big reason like a lot of people join us, is that, you know, most people love concerts. Most people want to make the world better now.
Yeah.
And you can make money doing it. So it's like a double whammy.
Capitalism at its finest, right?
Yeah, touche.
The nuts and bolts of the role I expect is like basically mass scale inventory management meets the, you've got other QR codes on the cups where people are returning, redeeming. So you've kind of got a combination of the inventory meets loyalty scheme meets hardware supply chain and processing system.
Exactly.
Is that about right?
Yeah. Another role would be like whoever runs Walmart's business, because that's really going to be our business in 3 years' time.
Yep.
You know, that same operational business.
We can track down some of those people, I'm sure. 10 years from now, you've made it. You're a multi-billionaire. What do you do next? What do you hope to be able to give back to the next generation coming behind you?
I think I hope that kids feel like anything's possible and you can do anything possible. When like when I started Tern, the iPhone just came out, right? And you could run your business from the phone. And I think now like you can have a $10 to $100 million business and not even really hire anyone at this point, you know? And like that whole world's changed as well. And I hope, particularly in New Zealand, that the kids somehow understand that early on versus like falling into the traditional system.
You texted me a YouTube link last night that I'm meant to watch for my kids' sake. I haven't watched it yet. What inspired you to send me that?
We go to this retreat, Maria, my fiance and I, every year, called Esalen, and Alan Watts, a famous philosopher, you know, wrote a lot of his books there. And one of his quotes was, man suffers because he takes what God made seriously.
Mm.
And the video I sent you was about a golem. I think in Jewish tradition, there's this like golem that doesn't know what it's doing, and it starts reading its environment and builds all these things, and then it disappears. And this video is of this wooden golem who literally just has a book and doesn't have anything else around it. And he starts realizing he's meant to build a woman. He builds this woman. And then once he's built the woman, he disappears, and then it starts over again. I think we all think in life we're meant to know what we're meant to be doing. There's this Judaism tradition, I think, which the golem tries to teach, of like everything's just in front of you and you make what you can with what's in front of you, but you're just going to disappear.
So the message is like life is short, nothing matters at the end of the day, so you might as well make the
most of what you have in front of you. Yeah, exactly. Yes. And I think that's hard because there's so much distraction, or there's people doing lots of things or making lots of money, or, you know, like met someone that you wanted to meet or whatever else it is. And you keep thinking, but really it was just you're writing your own book in front of you, and you're going to disappear anyway.
To tie us back to one of your comments at the very start of this conversation, you know, the farmer upbringing mentality, the do it yourself, the harder you work, the better. One thing, you know, you're not at the stage of having kids yet. Maybe you are in the future, but I don't know how you'd go about creating that kind of environment where their kids feel like they've actually got to work hard, particularly what you say about, you know, AI continue to come is true and life gets easier and easier as more of what we do gets abstracted and outsourced. How would you approach that question?
I think the thing that scares me the most is like you're so influenced by your environment. And in America, people hate Trump, particularly in San Francisco. And I always say, well, like if you're living at Trump's house for a year, do you think you'll still hate him, or would you have a different relationship with him, you know? Or would you perceive him differently?
Yep.
And so I think going to your question of like kids with hard work, I think it's like at an early age, you have to experience hard work to realize that you don't like it or you're going to be okay if you do it. It's like those two things. And like, I think for me, that probably came from like at boarding school where you're in constant competition with like 300 other boys, right? And you're rowing every single day, even though you don't want to get up at 6 o'clock, but the rest of your friends are going to essentially bully you if you don't go to rowing that day. And so you go to rowing school and you grind it out, even though you fucking hate it. And like, that's just one example. But like, I think for my kids, I also worked at a meatworks at a young age, you know, where people who are like blue collar, they literally showed up so they could drink coffee every 2 hours at their 15-minute break and smoke cigarettes and then go home and drink beers that night. You know, you have to have those experiences to then even appreciate anything else. And I think it's hard because I think you want your children not to have those experiences because you want them to have a better life than maybe that, you know, but without those experiences, they don't even understand that life. And maybe that life was okay as well.
Brings to mind the Jensen Huang quote that went around Twitter recently, speaking at Stanford School of Business, very privileged group of people with probably a lot of good things laid out in front of them. And the message is grit. The most important thing is company building and success is grit, and grit comes from pain and suffering. And I wish pain and suffering upon you all.
Yeah.
Which I struggle with a little bit as a parent. The other, just riff on the same idea of do it yourself, harder you work, the better. An observation I've made of Kiwi founders as we scale companies is that that is a fantastic way to get through the early years when you are, you know, a small company, you're just grinding it out to break out. And then once you've broken out, sometimes it can become an impediment when actually you should be outsourcing and you should be, you know, thinking about the team and empowering the team, not just working harder yourself the whole time.
Yeah.
Do you resonate with that? And if so, how have you sort of grown through that point? Have you had to unlearn any of your Kiwi traits in order to manage a team as you've grown?
When I started Turn, the 4-hour work week came out by Tim Ferriss, you know, and there was this huge philosophy for a group of people with me of like, okay, how do we start a business and work 4 hours a week? But really it was just a tagline to make you start the business and like want that. But really you could never do the business probably on 4 hours a week.
Right.
And I think part of the next world is, you're right, you need this grit understanding, but you also need to be, how do you outsource your whole business as well? It's like, do you want to be mowing your lawns every Saturday, or do you make enough money that you can pay someone to mow your lawns on Saturday, you know? And I think in New Zealand, they think, oh, why would you outsource your lawns when I can just mow my lawns myself, you know? But maybe yourself could be making $5,000 an hour versus mowing your lawns for $50 an hour, even though it's, you could easily do the work and you don't have to pay someone else to do that work.
Yep.
And I think that mindset's a hard one to make that switch off, but you have to have this philosophy that your time's worth more money than that, and you can be doing better things for the world and more things and more things for your family than mowing the lawns, even though you might happily mow the lawns and have the time to mow the lawns.
Mm.
But you might as well spend it looking after your kids because you're making so much money at that point. And the hard thing goes back to your question, like you want your kid to learn to mow the lawns, right? But your kids are our age. Like I was just in Belgium recently and there's just robotic lawnmowers everywhere, mowing everyone's lawns. You know, it's like no one's ever going to mow the lawns again. And I know that's like maybe a bad analogy for it, but I think at some point you have to step outside and say, it's better for me to go find more investors or more customers and make more money than be doing any of this other stuff in the business.
I both agree with you and still mow the lawns every Saturday.
I know.
Because it's a, I find it's a great time to consume my podcasts to create some space. But no, I'm totally with you. I wish I had the discipline and the sense of self-worth to value my time as such. Let's get back to the wrap-up part. Thank you for entertaining me through that. Final thoughts, just where can we find and follow you online? And in particular, is there anything that people should get in touch with you about it?
I think anything we do with climate tech or like welcome to reach out. My company taglines are at Turn, T-U-R-N on Twitter and at Turn, T-U-R-N on Instagram.
Tell me about your Twitter experiences, Kiwi. You have been active where most haven't and you've got value out of that.
For sure. I know you love Twitter. I think Twitter's a...
X now.
Oh yeah, fuck. Why do we call it Twitter? Everything still says X, formerly Twitter as well.
Yeah.
I think Twitter's, like all of these social networks, is a way to connect with certain groups of people, and you just have to be adding value to them in order to try and get value back.
And that's something that you did as you moved over. And
For sure.
I think others should do as well, but that's one of my sticks. Hey, that was fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us. Looking forward to getting this one live in the world and everyone following along with your story as well.
Thanks for having me.
Awesome.
Cheers.
That's a wrap. Thanks for listening. As a quick reminder, make sure you hit subscribe in your favorite podcast player so you can keep getting stories like this landing your feed every Friday, power you through those weekend chores. I want to give a quick shout out to the boys at Supermix who do all our editing. Zach and Xavier are Kiwi expats themselves. They're building a thriving business in the heart of New York City. A lot of respect. Not a sponsor, just a happy customer here. Also, for my day job, I'm an entrepreneur in residence and an investor at Blackbird Ventures. We're backing the best Kiwi founders wherever they are in the world. My personal sweet spot is pre-seed and seed. I like to say no check is too early, so drop me a line anytime. It's dbooth@blackbird.vc. We'll look forward to seeing you back next week.